Welcome to Pacific Mammal Research's Marine Mammal Highlight Series. We are a 501c3 research and education nonprofit studying marine mammals in the Salish Sea off Washington State. In this series, you will learn about different marine mammals as we discuss interesting facts about each species. This is our way to geek out, share some information, and have some fun. We hope you enjoy the series, and be sure to follow us on Instagram to vote for which animal we talk about next. And without further ado,
welcome to the Pac-Man podcast. I'm Cindy.
And I'm Kat.
And this week, so we're doing a marine mammal highlight, but you may have noticed that we didn't let you choose. That was due to a technical difficulty. I tried to do our Instagram story and it wouldn't let me choose the two pictures. So it just froze. And it was like, you can't do that. And so I couldn't put the two different pictures of the dolphins to choose from. So we just had to make an executive decision to choose one. We were going to do, it was the white-beaked dolphin versus the Atlantic white-sided dolphin. We're doing the battle of the two white in the name dolphins. And I basically said, I want to do white-beaked dolphin because I don't know much about those. So, and Kat was like, yeah, that sounds cool.
So that's where we are.
Yes. So we decided to do the white-beaked dolphin, and I promise, well, I can't promise anything because if the technology does that again, I don't know what it'll do. But theoretically, next time you guys will have choice in the matter. But the white-beaked dolphin is what we're doing this episode, and it's a very pretty looking dolphin, as Kat will be talking about. So I do suggest that you take a look if you're not watching this on YouTube, to take a look at the animal. But it's an interesting mix of not knowing a lot, but then knowing a lot of some stuff. So it's kind of fun.
Yeah.
So we'll let Kat start with the appearance and kind of where they're found.
Yeah, so white-beaked dolphins. I feel like I'm going to struggle to say that somehow.
It doesn't seem that hard of a word, but it really is when you're like saying it.
Say it multiple times fast. Okay, I'll try to talk slower. That might help. So these guys are basically found in the cold temperate waters and subpolar waters throughout the North Atlantic Ocean. So basically we're talking Eastern North America, Northern Europe, Scandinavia, Greenland, the UK, and also the Barents Sea. The distribution within the U.S. waters is somewhat limited. They're mostly found around the kind of Massachusetts up to Newfoundland in Canada. And I'm sure Cindy will talk about this a little bit more when we get into diet and behavior, but they do prefer waters that are less than 650 feet deep typically. So we're talking kind of more like the kind of coastal waters for the most part. Distribution of the white-beaked dolphin does vary with seasons. So again, we'll get into more of that when we talk about their behavior. But you know, kind of a winter summer variation happening, which again likely has to do with sea ice levels and also forage, where they're foraging and where they're getting food.
Yeah, and what prey they're eating.
Yes, which I'm excited to hear about because I purposefully did not look into that at all. So
interesting.
I can learn along with everyone else. So you might be wondering with the name white-beaked dolphin, what they look like. So these guys are a little bit more sturdy of a dolphin species, and they are about kind of 8 to 10 feet in length, typically. They can weigh anywhere from up to 395 to 770 pounds. So that's a pretty big range.
Yeah,
a little chunky, a little more like beefy rugby player-esque, which kind of makes sense in those North Atlantic waters. Like that's some pretty gnarly water up there. Pretty stormy. The males are typically larger than the females. So when we're talking about that upper range, that's more likely to be the male animals that are up into that 770 pound range. And in terms of their coloration, their body is mostly gray or black on the upper sides and the back. They have light gray or white patches on their flanks. And the back actually has a really cool kind of almost saddle patch that is created because most of the top of the dolphin is darker. They do have this lighter patch that creates kind of a saddle patch, almost like you would see on an orca. And then they also have a lighter underbelly as well. The dorsal fin flippers and tail are typically dark. So again, you kind of have this dark cape effect with like a lighter underbelly and then kind of light gray or white patches on the sides.
It almost reminded me of like the hourglass dolphins and common dolphins that have those kind of tri-coloration, that mixture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And clues in the name, but they do have short little beaks, which are really cute. And they actually have white lips. So like right on the end of the snout is white. But Not all of the animals have completely white beaks. So
Some of
some
them
of them do have,
lipstone.
well, so some of them have completely white beaks, right? And then they, it was interesting. Apparently, a study in 2016 found that only around 7% of the adults they found had completely white beaks.
So
So, you know,
age
little white
difference.
lips, but not everybody has the full white beak. And yeah, I'm not sure if it's to do with an age thing or if it's just individual variation. I know that the coloration does vary significantly between individuals and age classes. So it might be a combination of both of those things.
But
But really interesting.
yeah, like in Atlantic spotted dolphins, there are some some sexual differences, not great ones, but like the males will oftentimes have more, I forgot exactly what it is, but like more whitish on the rostrum, I think, from different forage like that. But like there are indications in different cetaceans of that, of it changes as they get older. And then also, but the individual variation also, because the like the common is, I think, the common dolphin that has, like, someone did an infographic of all the crazy variations there are
Oh, yeah.
in animals. There's like 15 different variations they've seen. So I think when you
Yeah.
have all those mixtures, it gets real muddled what it looks like.
Yeah, but it's kind of neat where it just, again, I didn't really realize how much variation there was, and apparently there is a ton. So,
Yeah, I mean, all the pictures I saw, I was like, they all have that, like, I mean, the whole beak is white, and it's like
yeah.
it's almost like they're wearing a mask, right there. That's
Yeah.
like, yeah.
Yeah, that's actually a good way to describe it, but not necessarily. So if you happen to see these animals and they don't have a fully white beak, it does not necessarily mean that they are not white-beaked dolphins. They may
And
still
that,
be.
yeah, and I think that because they do say that because there's the Atlantic white-sided, which is the one that we
Which I'll
rub
get
against,
to.
yeah, which like they can be
Yeah.
confused, yeah.
Yeah. So before we get into a couple things of why they're different than the Atlantic white-sided dolphin, let's talk about the name. So obviously, the common name white-beaked dolphin, we kind of just covered why they were called that, right? So they have these white lips. A lot of the animals, in theory, have white beaks, or at least some of them do. But their Latin name is kind of interesting as well and feeds into the same thing. So their Latin name is Ligneorhynchus albirostris. And the genus name comes from the two words lagenos, which means bottle, and rhynchus meaning beak, so bottle beak. And
That's why
the
all the lags are
I
that
know. Isn't that fun? I thought that I also thought it was interesting because they have a much shorter beak than a lot of the other Ligneorhynchus dolphins.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, most of the other actually quite, much longer. And
But
with that, just as no, you may heard me say lags. That's what a lot of people will shorten the Ligneorhynchus to lags. You'll say, oh, we're talking about lags. That's so if we say that, that's what that means.
Yeah, so
All the
that's referring to
Ligneorhynchus.
that genus. Yeah, exactly. And then the species name Albirostris means white beak. So again, clues in the name. So like Cindy said, these guys can be misidentified quite easily as the Atlantic white-sided dolphin, which was the other species that we were putting these guys up against, which is kind of funny. The reason being that A, the coloration is similar, not the same, and they are not the same species, but it is similar, and their ranges overlap considerably. So these guys are both found in the North Atlantic. So it can be challenging, especially if you happen to see them when you're at sea, or if you're just in passing, you might not be able to identify which is which. However, if you happen to live in that part of the world or visit, let me tell you a couple ways that you can ID the white-beaked dolphins versus the white-sided dolphins. So the white-beaked dolphin is typically larger than the white-sided dolphin. Again, like I said, they are those kind of like more chunky, hefty, solid-looking animals. The white-sided dolphin is a little bit more petite. And the white-sided dolphin also has what they call yellow streaks. So almost more like a common dolphin, where they do actually have like a almost like a yellow stripe on the side that the white-beaked dolphin does not have. So if you see any kind of like yellowish coloring on there, it's not going to be a white-beaked dolphin. The white-beaked dolphins are also found more typically in more northerly waters than most other dolphins. So if you're up pretty far north and you're seeing anything that looks vaguely like these guys, you're probably seeing a white-beaked dolphin. And if you happen to find one dead on the beach, the white-beaked dolphin has less teeth than the white-sided dolphin. So the white-beaked dolphin, I believe, has about 20 to 28 teeth. And the white-sided dolphin, I think, has somewhere up closer to like 30 or 40. So if you happen to find a dead one, then you want to count the teeth. There you go.
That's like when we do dolphins versus porpoises. Like, well, if you ever see the inside of their mouths, cone shaped teeth versus spade shaped teeth. Like, no, most people aren't going to see that, but that's okay.
So, I mean, to sum up, I know we kind of bounced around a lot in this section more than we normally do, but basically, these guys are found in North Atlantic waters, pretty far north. They're robust. They have a nice, cute little short beak. They are up 8 to 10 feet, and they have that kind of, like Cindy said, that sort of tri-coloration. So dark on top, little bit of a saddle patch, light on the sides, and then that distinctive white lips or white beak, and then like a little kind of white ring around the eye as well. So they, like Cindy said, almost as like they're wearing a mask or have little eye patches. They're really, really very pretty. And that's what these guys look like and where they live.
And do we want to do more than their name?
Ooh, yeah. So then we also have three, which will lead nicely into the diet and behavior. So their other, again, their common name is the white-beaked dolphin. The other common names that they have in English, because there were a ton of other common names in different languages, which I am not going to attempt to say and offend anybody on here. But they had Springer dolphins, jumper dolphins, or squid hounds,
I love this.
which let me hear about why, because I'm so excited.
I will tell you, and that one is specifically the squid hounds is I saw was specifically from Canadians that have.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the other ones were more generalized, but yeah. So
Interesting.
those
Okay.
do go into the quite well the diet and behavior of what they do. So with their behavior, you would imagine with the names Springer and Jumper. They do like to jump around. Jump around, jump around. Right. old school.
If you know, you know.
Right, exactly. So they are very commonly will like breach. They jump a lot. They just tend to like they'll surf the bow and the stern of vessels. So they are fairly social in that respect. And so they got those fun names. Other behaviors, so they're kind of like normal dolphin groups of 5 to 30, so usually less than 10. So that's a fairly common small dolphinid social structure or group structure. But it's not unusual to see up to 1500. So they can get into those
What?
very large, almost like the Pacific
1500.
whitecap is where they're just, a thousand of them.
That is so cool.
It's more uncommon, but it's not unusual, right? So it's that thing in the middle. And that's, I think, somewhat typical of oceanic species as well, that you will see them in these larger groups just for food or for predator protection, etc. And Kat will talk about predators later. So the groups can be organized by age and sex. I couldn't really find out much more. I do have some new research on social structure, which is exciting. But there wasn't too much detail on what that means, but there can be some kind of differentiation there. They are very social in with other species as well. So sometimes they're seen with fin whales, humpback whales, and sei whales. And
Wow.
they seem to be attracted to them. And the going theory is that maybe they're there to catch the fish that the whales miss. So if they're all going after similar fish species, when those guys gulp, there's going to be some that flies off the side and they can grab an easy meal.
Interesting.
I wonder also if they've ever seen them bow ride or wake ride on those whale species, because we know other dolphins
Ooh.
do that, right?
Yeah, that'd be neat.
And then they also, while feeding, may associate in mixed groups with bottlenose dolphins, short-beaked common dolphins, Rizzo's dolphins, and Atlantic white-sided dolphins, of course. They're all kind of doing the same thing. There has been some photo ID done on these guys, and I'm going to save that more for the new research because that's more relatively new. But in terms of how far they go in their be in you know in that behavior, they most of the studies I'm going to talk about later are all in Iceland. Seems to be the place that they're doing the most research. And they found that much of their time was spent traveling, and one was that was tagged covered 5,000 kilometers in 201 days.
Wow.
So they do have some movement, and we'll talk about that in the new research as well. They're not like just hanging out in one spot and staying, which is interesting.
Yeah.
They have, as Kat mentioned before, they do have some seasonal movement. So it looks like they move north in the summer and then south in the winter to stay in their preferred water temperature. which is an important determinant on their habitat use. So,
and we will talk about that when it comes to threats.
Yes. Excellent. Excellent. And I do have another thing in research that links to climate change and that because of that. So water temperature is important for them. And then the rest of the behavior I've got, they do a lot of vocalization. So they whistle, squeaks, buzzes, clicks, and those burst pulses, which we've talked about in other podcasts, which are those communicative clicks that are like click whistles, and we have a hard time understanding what the heck they are. but they do seem to produce many different sounds to communicate with one another. For feeding, so now we're going to go back to that squid hound. Now, this name is funny because, yes, they do eat squid, but mostly not. So they eat mainly schooling fish like haddock, hake, cod, herring, whiting. They will also eat crustaceans, shrimp, and crab, and of course cephalopods, squid, and octopi. Some were even found to have seaweed in their stomachs. Now, whether they ate that on purpose or not is, I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, so here's a question. Because I couldn't find anywhere that they explained like where that name came from. Would it be more because you said that was more around the Canadian waters that they were called that? Is that because there was a squid fishery and they were just seen when the fishermen were out fishing for squid?
So that, I don't know. They only said that the squid hounds came from some Canadians, but I will say in the new research of the variation in diet and how varied it is in different locations.
Okay.
Primary thing they eat is very different in different locations. And so that's probably why maybe they just eat more squid and octopi up in Canada.
Yeah.
Or that specific interesting location, you know, could be very
right.
Location dependent.
Yeah.
In one study, they found 25 different species in stomach contents. So
wow.
Super picky either. And again, that dominant prey does vary by location. And I'll dive more into that later. I get it. See what I did there.
I actually didn't at all.
Gotta pass you.
I'm like immune to marine mammal puns.
Right. I've done so much. So they do have cooperative feeding, so they will work together to catch fish at the surface. So the group will herd and encircle schooling fish and trap them at the surface. But they also will feed along the ocean bottom, which I'm glad you brought up the depth, because I actually couldn't really find anything on their dive. The deepest, or well, I found one thing on the deepest side, but like where they're located in habitat. But their short dive times indicate that they probably don't like super deep waters. So there's only been one that has been tagged with a biologger. So this is, take it with a grain of salt, because this is one individual. But they did fairly shallow dives to a mean depth of 24 meters, and the deepest was 45 meters. So that's only like 130 or 40 feet, something like that, a little over 120. And the max dive was 78 seconds. So that's only like not even a minute and a half.
But
usually shorter mean of 28 seconds. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So they are mainly, I think, at least if this guy is representative, mainly surface feeders and don't need to dive very deep. And that's why they're in that more shallow water. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I guess that also kind of to some degree explains why they're so active at the surface. Because if they're not expending a ton of energy in these long, deep dives, like they have energy to kill, I mean, you know, relatively speaking, you could afford to be more playful and more kind of boisterous at the surface than if you were doing like thousands of feet dives
when you get to
every
surface,
20 minutes.
Like, I gotta rest.
Right. You're like, okay. Right. So yeah, interesting. Very interesting.
Yeah. So that's pretty much what I have for diet and behavior. They eat a lot of different things, but varies by location and fairly shallow. They like the surface, like to hang out in the light in the upper section of the water.
Fair enough.
So then with reproduction, almost forgot. I love this one said we have unknown lifespan. And I'm like, okay. And then I found other ones that said basically they can live more than 30 years. So we still really don't know for sure, but more than 30. So they're probably on par with most dolphins that are 30, you know, 40, 50 years. Males grow faster than females, and males are larger. Mm-hmm. Again, which you mentioned. They don't know a whole lot about their reproduction, but except that mating and birth will likely occur in summer months, which again makes sense, especially they're in colder waters. You're going to have babies when it's the warmest. So mid-April to late August. And this is due to the testes size that they've they've documented. A lot of the work that they've done has been on stranded animals. But their testing size being twice the size of baseline. So during that time frame.
Wow.
So there's basically like, well, if they're that big at that point, that's probably when they're having babies.
Or when they're would make sense.
So things you learn. And then strandings of newborns and young tend to increase in June through September. So that's probably the time they're giving birth. Gestation is 11 months. So that would make sense. They're mating and giving birth in those summer months. The interbirth interval is unknown. They do not know how often they have babies. And females reach sexual maturity between 6 to 10. And males are later at 8 to 12, which is also fairly common in dolphins. But going back to that considerable variation in individuals, there is considerable variation in age and size at sexual maturity for both sexes. For example, one immature male was 16 years old.
Whoa.
So.
Wow. Like, that's crazy. What happened to that guy?
I don't know. And maybe he's like the weirdest outlier ever. And that just happened to be, or maybe he was never going to get mature because the, you know, something physiological.
Right. Right. True.
But there's some to why it's not as set as another species, which is interesting.
Yeah, these guys have a lot of variability.
Yeah, which I think makes it also that much harder to do things. You're like, this is how they do it. Well, except when they don't, which is
right. Yeah, a lot harder to like classify what we know about them. Interesting. Exactly.
So that's what I have for the fascinating facts of dying behavior. We will take a quick break and get back with the threats and then some new research. So we'll take just a moment and we'll be right back.
Hello, listeners. This is Cindy, the research director at Pacific Mammal Research. And I wanted to take just a minute to thank you for listening and supporting our work. And I wanted to see maybe if you wanted to learn a little bit more about the background of what we do and what we see in the field and other kind of cool information that you can get by subscribing to the podcast for only $5 a month. You can get ad-free episodes as well as these mini episodes where we discuss the things we've seen in the field, the stuff we've gone to with workshops, and other little interesting tidbits of information for our subscribers only. This is a great way to help support PacMam, who we are a very small nonprofit, so every dollar helps us continue the work that we do and provide the information and the fun podcast that we have that hopefully you guys are enjoying. So if you can, think about it, subscribe to the podcast and help support our work, and we hope you enjoy.
All right, we are back. So Kat, tell us about that stuff.
Yeah, well, it's not as bad as some of the other species we've had to talk about. So this is, you know, we're okay on this one. So first of all, let's talk about their status worldwide. So they are listed as an IUCN species of least concern, basically because we don't know a lot about them. And because we think, as far as what we do know, their populations are fairly steady. So I could not find a global population estimate. I think, again, because these guys are, there's a pretty huge range and it's hard to do surveys up in those waters because, again, it can get pretty stormy and the seas are not conducive to doing lots and lots of research up there. Yeah. But I do have a couple kind of regional estimates based on aerial surveys and boat surveys. So the Western North Atlantic stock, which would be kind of the US and Canada stock, this is from a 2016 aerial survey, was estimated to be around about 500,000. So like a pretty solid population in and around the Western North Atlantic stock, as far as we know. Around Greenland from 2015 surveys, it was estimated to be around 4,900 animals. So, you know, close to that 5,000 mark. Iceland, again, this is from a 2016 aerial survey, was around about 60,000 animals or individuals. And then in and around the North Sea region, this is, it was going to be about 187,500. So that's from a survey that was done between 2014 and 2018. Okay. So like pretty robust numbers. Again, you know, we'll talk about this in the threats, but they're not, you know, they're not like hunted a ton. They are still hunted actively, but they're not, there's no commercial fishery for these guys. So as far as we know, the populations are doing okay. Which is great. Finally, we get one that's like, we think they're doing okay, guys. So let's talk about what is threatening these guys. So as I say, one of the big ones is hunting. Like I said, there's no commercial fishery for white-beaked dolphins, but basically what we're talking about here is small subsistence scale hunting. That occurs mostly in Greenland, Norway, Iceland, the Faroe Islands, and some parts of Canada still. So there was a little bit more information given on the Greenland hunt. And so I'll just talk about that for a few minutes. So the hunting is allowed year round. But basically what that means is that it's kind of opportunistic takes. So there's no quotas or catch limits. The numbers are reported and monitored annually with the numbers of catches that are made. Canada also allows opportunistic takes, again, mostly from Newfoundland and Labrador area. But from what is reported, it seems to be relatively few animals every year. It's like, you know, like 10 to 20-ish every year, if that. Right. So quite a lot of variability. Again, because these guys have never been subjected to a massive commercial hunt, I think that's why the population seems to be fairly stable still. Mm-hmm. So as far as we know, the subsistence hunting is not a hugely damaging thing to their population. But of course, it is something we need to keep an eye on. If the population does start to suffer, that's something we need to be a lot more careful of. Moving into another human interaction, which is bycatch. So this one actually is a little bit more concerning because we don't really have a great handle on the number of animals that are bycaught every year. So as you might expect, being in the North Atlantic, these guys are very susceptible to gill net bycatch and bycatch in trawling nets from commercial fisheries. In one study they had in Iceland, that they had scars and wounds that were suspected to come from fishery interactions on 15 out of 90 photo ID'd dolphins. So, you know, a solid like 10-ish percent of the animals, 10 to 15%, had visible scars of interactions with fisheries. Of course, as we've talked about in other podcasts, bycatch is not just something that can injure you. You can also, you know, the animals can be drowned by being caught in nets. And interestingly enough, apparently bycatch resulting in drowning was reported as being fairly common in Newfoundland and Labrador. And it is thought to be largely underreported because basically if they drown in the nets, they're not causing damage to the net. So it's easy to just dispose of them and not have to report it versus like, why is there a big hole in your net? What happened here?
Well, we had to cut them out. Yeah.
Right. So that is a little concerning given how heavily those waters in the North Atlantic are fished. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as we continue to experience climate change, which we'll move to next, and other fish species move north, and those fisheries potentially increase in size, you know, these guys are susceptible, especially if they're moving in large numbers, to bycatch. And again, the fact that it's reported is fairly common, but like not reported a lot, that's worrying.
Yeah.
Especially because we don't really have a handle on their global population numbers. So while we think they're doing okay, we don't really know what the numbers are. So something to be mindful of. As we've alluded to several times now, climate change is worrying for the white-beaked dolphin. And that is because, as Cindy said, they are heavily dependent on water temperature. So they show a strong preference for those cooler waters. And actually, there has been recent research around the UK that suggests that the white-beaked dolphins are shifting northward. And their populations in and around the west coast of Scotland are actually declining as they move north. So
was that the... I never can pronounce the name correctly. Isildike study.
Oh, I'm not sure.
Okay. Because I have one that was, it's the North Sea. There's a higher density of animals in the southern countries in earlier years, but a slightly increased densities in the northwestern area more recently. And that might be the first indication of a change in habitat and population distribution from south to north. And the potential explanation is the observed shift is climate change and effect mm-hmm. on prey distribution. So that is...
Yeah, so this might be pulling from that, possibly. Yeah. I mean, this was specifically referencing that they were declining in the west coast of Scotland because you have increasing sea temps there.
Right.
So it might be related to that study.
Yeah, they're pushing farther north because everything's getting warmer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's not just about prey distribution. That's also increasing the likelihood of parasites and pathogens being able to survive and increase in the population. And I guess lampreys, which are a parasitic species, have been observed on white-beaked dolphins in Iceland for the first time in the last sort of like 10 years or so. So it is something that they're actually seeing evidence of these animals that typically are not found in colder waters starting to show up and actually directly impacting and literally latching onto the species.
And with those species not having grown up around them, that it evolved around them, it's going to be an issue.
Yeah. So climate change is definitely going to be impacting these guys more, which I actually thought quite interesting because I didn't realize they had such a strong relationship with sea temperature. Yeah. You know, we tend to think of climate change mostly interacting with polar species. But again, these guys live in the northerly waters. They live in cold water. So kind of a good reminder for all of us that it does impact those species who don't directly necessarily live in the Arctic. As well. And then finally, predation. So again, because these are pretty beefy dolphins, really the only predators naturally that they have are orcas, some of the larger shark species, like Greenland shark, for example. Very rarely they have seen polar bears attacking these guys in and around the Canadian waters, but that's apparently pretty rare, which makes sense.
That's gonna be hard for a polar bear to I mean, it's gotta be like trapped in ice or something. I mean,
right. I was gonna say, yeah, like where you would actually see this happening, I'm not quite sure, because you'd have like an 8 to 10 foot dolphin battling with a polar bear in the open water. It would be interesting.
That would be like seeing like the sperm whale and the giant squid. Like just like polar bear like to going at it.
Mostly we're talking like orcas, you know, killer whales up and around the North Atlantic waters are really the main predator, and then as I say, a couple larger shark species might be in there as well, but it does help when you're a little bit chunky and move in large groups, you're less inclined to be eaten on by other species.
We just saw a picture of in here in the Salish Sea of an orca tossing a harbor porpoise into the air. And so remember, harbor porpoises are 150 pounds, like 5 foot. So, but I mean, it just chunked it in the air, like 15, 20 feet in the air. It was flying. Yep. So, you know, it's just it was a good reminder of the abilities of orcas. I mean, it's amazing. And so it's always powerful. That same thing of like, I always feel bad for the prey, and especially harbor porpoises, because that's our study animals. But at the same time, like, oh my God, what the amazing things that orcas can do in their predation. So and possibly, you know, eating these large giant dolphins. They're not giant dolphins, but larger dolphins. Pretty crazy.
Yeah. 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 It's interesting. So yeah, let's hear about the new research.
Yeah. It's nice not to have like too much sadness in that.
I know. Like, thanks guys. This is like a pretty positive vibe with these ones.
Just keep the climate change down. So I already talked about that. The Isildike, hopefully I'm saying that name correctly. I apologize if I'm not. This is a 2018 study, and so that they were looking at strandings. So they were looking at the frequency of the strandings of when that happened, seeing that change to the northern regions, which is probably due to climate change and warmer waters. Along the lines on disease, this one's not too new. It's like 2014, so it's like 10 years. But I found it interesting because it's on dolphin morbillivirus. So they were looking at is dolphin morbillivirus virulent in these animals, like, will it, is it bad for them basically? Because for most, like a lot of large strandings and mass strandings happen due to morbillivirus in a lot of different dolphin species. And so they had two dolphins in rehab that had it, but the cause of death was not attributed to the DMV infection. So not due to the morbillivirus infection, it was something, other things. And then the virus was not detected in two contemporaneously stranded white-beak dolphins, so on the same ones, in the same time frame, and the same with those guys that had it, and the stranding rate did not increase in the region, and so the results suggest that DMV is not highly virulent for white-beak dolphins, so it's not as spreadable or dangerous as, I guess virulent is more about danger, not about spreading, but apparently they can like handle it and not die.
Interesting.
Which may be good if they have good immune systems, whether you're talking about climate change and parasites and diseases, maybe they're more adept to dealing with the changes that might occur from climate.
Yeah, I mean, it does make me wonder though, like if you do have something like that, even if it's more background and it's not going to kill you, what does that do to your overall immune health in general?
And it may not be, they doesn't kill it, but then it lowers it so much that other things kill it. So yes.
Right. So yeah, it's not necessarily passive, but right, not necessarily, you know, bad enough to cause death in these animals.
Right. I guess so. Step one is great. It doesn't kill you. Fantastic. You can
Right,
go
but does it lower your immune system enough that other things could?
could be
Who
probably,
knows?
and that probably is an individual variation as well, depending on a lot of different factors. So the next couple are from 2015. This is, and a lot of these are actually the next four are all by Bertulli. So they are doing a lot of research on these guys. But I was really interested because they were doing a lot of photo ID and social structure. So that, of course, always gets my attention. So they had photo ID marks in Iceland. So they were looking at the ability to use these markings for photo ID for these animals. And so they found that white-beaked dolphins had notch and fin patches and fine scrapes as the most prevalent marks. And a black mark and fine scrape were the most abundant. So there were on the dorsal fin, basically, these things. And there were 13 mark types that had what they called null lo loss rate, which were the notch, distinct notch, and amputation. So probably good to use for things. You don't lose the individuals. And the findings confirm that fin and injury marks are among the most accurate features to use from capture mark recapture studies, as noted for other species. So basically, use the dorsal fin and any injuries that happen along with that. Fin patches for white-beaked dolphins, in particular, due to the low loss rate. So those patches of, I think, somewhat pigmentation, are good for photo ID. Yeah, that was very cool. And that's what they do with common dolphins down in New Zealand, right? They have the coloration and the patches on the dorsal fin are unique and good for doing that. So I always like seeing photo ID being used on animals that you don't really think about doing photo ID on. So then in that same year, there's another study that looked at site fidelity in Iceland. And they were conducted from April to October, most likely because that's when the seas are the least bad up there in the North Sea. And these were during whale watching operations in Faxaflói and Skjalfandi. Sorry if I butchered those names, but those are the two bays on the southwest and northeast coasts of Iceland. And so they did minimum abundance, annual site fidelity, and movement between bays. And they found 154 individuals in Faxaflói and 52 individuals in the other bay. And the annual residing rate was about 21% in Faxaflói, and well, only one individual was resided in Skjalfandi Bay. So much more site fidelity in one versus the other, which was.
Interesting.
And they found a total of five dolphins, about 2.3%, that were matched between the two bays. So there is some movement between the two. And the period between residings ranged from 272 to 821 days, with a mean of 28.16 days. So there's a fair amount of time that they're going between these two places. And I don't know exactly how far they are in, geographically, each other. But we did see that other one in 200 days went 5,000 kilometers. So they can travel. So they said the low site fidelity rates observed likely signify a much larger home range than the present study area they were looking at, into either other coastal or offshore zones, or alternatively may be explained by a large natural population size and or the opportunistic nature of the sampling, right? So that was whale watching, so it wasn't a dedicated service. But it goes to what we were talking about before. The distribution does seem to be a much larger, right? They don't have like small home ranges where they stick to one place. They're moving around while still having some fidelity to certain areas, possibly.
Wow, interesting.
Oh, and so this one actually goes on the coloration you were talking about before. This is again in Iceland by Bertulli. From 2002 to 2014, they, again using whale watching trips as a platform of opportunity, they captured photographs. They found on 823 images, they found 571 individuals showing one or more color components. And they were adult, so they looked at, they found adults, juveniles, calves, and neonates. A total of 26 color components were observed and described, seven terms previously applied to white-beaked dolphins, 12 previously applied to other dolphin species, and seven newly defined terms of these coloration patterns. And so what the results showed that each age class could be positively identified by differences in specific color components, some of which are exclusive. So, yeah. So therefore, the color patterns may be useful in estimating maturity in these dolphins, just like we do with spotted dolphins, right? They're born
yeah.
with a two-tone and then they gain spots. So these coloration patterns are very, seem to be very age-specific, at least in some aspect. Isn't that neat?
Wow, that's really neat.
I don't think there's, I really only think about Atlantic spotted dolphins in terms of like being able to age very fairly easily by just looking at their pictures of them.
Yeah, I think any other species, you're pretty much just talking like aging between like a calf and an adult.
Right.
Like, yeah. So within the first year, the coloration changes, but after that, it's just kind of, okay, well, then you're just the same color as everyone else.
Yeah, like the juvenile, there is no juvenile section for most of the species that we think about. Even we were just talking with our colleagues.
Yeah, interesting.
And it looks like, yeah, there's definitely a young calf and then an adult, but then there's a short time where they just turn into mini adults, and there's you can't tell the difference really between that juvenile
mm-hmm.
and adult. So thought that was very cool. Interesting going on those color pattern variations.
Yeah.
Then the next one was by Bertulli, and this one really got me because it's all about social structure, and that's my jam. So they have basically fission fusion dynamics. So this was the first long-term assessment of this for white-beaked dolphins. They used a sock frog, which is super awesome. And again, those two bays that I talked about before, and the whale watching. So it's an 11-year data set. They had 487 dolphins that were suggested to be an open population, as was already kind of shown before. 35 adults were used in the study that were sighted on greater than 5 different days. So to look at social structure, you need to have a minimum sighting record to be able to accurately define what's going on. So the mean residency time within the two study areas was 95 days. And the model that they used that described the movements was migration, full interchange. So I think there's quite a bit of movement in and out of those two sites. The social differentiation was high, which means that there are diverse non-random social relationships. They do have preferred and avoided companions. And the temporal associations best fit the casual acquaintances model, which basically means that there's some just like, hey, we hang out for a little bit, whatever, but there's also long-term relationships. So in analyzing that data, they saw that a lot of the associations were short-term, but there were a few, some long-term across years relationships. So short-term, but with desirably long-term associations fitting into a society with that fission fusion, what we see with other dolphins. Like, there are lots of short-term relationships, but there are some of those anchoring long-term relationships that these animals have. So really cool being applied to an oceanic species that we know less about and can be in such large groups. At times, very interesting to understand more about that.
Yeah.
The last two that I have are now not Bertulli. we're done with all their work, which was fantastic. And these are just real quick. Oh, these ones. So the reason why these are here is because these are interactions with harbor porpoises. And I could not put this in. Because, So the first one is in 2011. And this was two cases of physical interaction between white-beaked dolphins and juvenile harbor porpoises.
Uh-oh.
And so basically they had these individuals that they found that had stranded but had survived the injuries that they've had from the animals. So they have the basically like rake marks that were consistent with white-beaked dolphins and not any of the other species that are around them.
Ooh.
Yeah. So they had scrapes along their like the pec fins and dorsal fin, things like that. And I said, given that the animals in the study survived and given the numerous rake marks on the one animal that was in Belgium in particular, the most plausible explanation for the interaction is object-oriented, playful, or investigative behavior by white-beaked common dolphins. But for harbor porpoises, the interaction would have nonetheless been traumatic. Which I think is
well, yeah, because when you're the object being played with, that's a little traumatic.
Right? Like, I'm not a ball, people. Like, I'm not a fish. Like, stop messing with me.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, so it's kind of like we have a new puppy, and my puppy plays with my 3.5-year-old, almost 4-year-old, but she doesn't really love it, and they're almost the same size. Like, so the object-oriented play there, my daughter is not excited about that. understandably. So same thing for the harbor porpoises. But the fact that the harbor porpoises survived and that their wounds are healed indicates that they were weaned at the time of the interaction, or that their mother would still have been in the vicinity. So it's at least they're not like the bottlenose dolphins that just boot them and kill them.
I was gonna say, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess if you're gonna have to be played with by one of those two species, I'd pick the white-beaked dolphin.
Yeah, and for those of you who are not familiar with what we're talking about, the bottlenose dolphins are actually at this point fairly well known to aggressively, quote unquote, play with harbor porpoises to the point that they will kill them, like ramming them, and again, kind of similar to orcas, like booping them out, you know, like yep. ramming them out of the water. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, and they're still not sure exactly why they do that, but there's many. Thoughts on what that is, but still being researched. And so the last one is in 2022, so very recent, Samara et al. And this is the trophic ecology. So looking at, are these overlapping harbor porpoises and white-beaked dolphins overlapping in foraging and things like that. And so they looked at the two and they had non-overlapping isotopic niches. So basically they're looking at the nitrogen content in their prey, and seeing if they are eating at the same level in the ecosystem. Harbor porpoises had a smaller niche width than white-beaked common dolphins, had a broader diet. Again, they had like 25 different species in one study. They had contributions of other fish species. For the white-beaked dolphins, they had gadoids. That's a general grouping of fishes. And other fish species, harbor porpoises fed most exclusively on capelin, and that suggests that there's niche segregation and basically maintained by targeting different prey. Right? They basically just don't overlap in what they eat, which is a great way to live together.
Yeah, because these guys do, again, like similar to white-sided dolphins, these guys do overlap considerably in their range, harbor porpoise and white-beaked dolphins. So yeah. Very cool.
And both species also showed no long-term changes in trophic ecology. Despite recent ecosystem changes in the region and what we just talked about with climate change. So possibly a result of adapting to spatial changes in prey distribution or shifts to other prey at similar trophic levels. So they're adapting to whatever changes are occurring. And so we're not seeing changes in their diet, which is...
That's encouraging.
Which is encouraging, yeah. Like they're able to deal with whatever, however they're dealing, whether they're moving north, like we talked about, or there's just shifting to a different prey species or something, they're able to handle what's changing. So... kind of a nice one to end on, like
yeah, yay, we can good job guys,
fun, right? You're doing well. So with that is all about the white-beaked common dolphin. I keep wanting to put common in there, and I don't know.
I was gonna say, I'm like, what's the common,
it's
part?
A white-beaked common dolphin. It's a white.
No, it's a white-beaked dolphin. The yes. common dolphin is something else, and I think we've already talked about that. So go listen to that podcast.
Yes, exactly. Refresh. Apparently, I need to refresh on that. So the white-beaked common dolphin, super awesome little species. So with that, I want to remind you to go check out our new website. Kat did an amazing job on our fantastic new website. She did all the design and implementing it over, and I was just there to support her.
much needed at certain times when you try to transition from biology to web design. It's interesting.
But she did a great job, so go check it out. It's newly revamped and super awesome, and hopefully even better, easier to find things and all the things that you want to check out. So do check that out. We do have the merch store there. Again, we have some cool new merchandise and different types of things like hoodies and hats that you can get. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast, and that is also a great way to support us in the getting the podcast to you. So we are, again, a small nonprofit, so every little bit goes back to helping with our research and education initiatives. So next week we will be, or next week, next episode will be a journal or topic of interest. So if you have any ideas of what we should talk about, please drop them in I think you can comment on Spotify, but you can also find us on our socials on Instagram and Facebook. Drop us a line, let us know what you want to talk about, and we'd be happy to discuss. So with that, we will leave you hanging on what we're going to talk about next time, and we'll see you then. Bye.
Bye.
This was brought to you by Pacific Mammal Research, a 501c3 nonprofit organization. To learn more about the species we discuss, check out our blog. Head to our website, www.pacmam.org, that's pacmam.org, to check it out. Also, help us continue providing fun and educational content like this by donating today. Your help is how we can continue to do our work and share it with you. Thanks.